Hello, and welcome to the Sound of Economics podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic policy think tank. My name is Matt Dunn, I'm the Secretary General of Bruegel, and I'll be hosting this episode of the Bruegel Backstage series, where we go behind the scenes at events in which Bruegel is involved and speak to some of the participants. Today we're at the Global Think Tank Summit in Brussels, and I'm very happy to welcome James G. McGann, who is Director of the Think Tank and Civil Society Program at the Lauder Institute at the University of Pennsylvania. Hello, Dr. McGann. May I call you Jim?
Yes, you may. Only my mother, when she wanted to get my attention, called me James. So.
I don't want to be your mother, don't worry. I'm also happy to welcome Milena Lazarevic, who is Program Director and Co-Founder of the European Policy Center in Belgrade, Serbia.
Hello, Matt. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And finally, we have Edward Kofi Annan Brown, Senior Director for Research and Policy Advisory Services at the African Center for Economic Transformation in Ghana. Hello, Ed. So, first of all, Jim, can you tell us a little bit about the University of Pennsylvania's Think Tank and Civil Societies program, how long it's been running, what are its aims, and so on?
Yes, it was started in 1989, and the first major initiative was at the request of Joseph Stiglitz at the World Bank, who had at the time was developing the Global Development Network, and asked myself and Kent Weaver, who was a scholar at Brookings, and both of us had written on think tanks, to convene a group of think tank scholars from around the world, which we did, and was the first international meeting. And oddly, but appropriately for this meeting, the view was that the concept of think tank did not travel well cross borders. And now, in 2018, clearly the term has been globalized, and this meeting we're having here today is not only affirmation of the global dimensions and the importance of think tanks, but also the fact that there is a common element, a shared sense of the challenges and the opportunities that think tanks face and the important role that they play in governments and civil societies around the world. And so the 120 plus think tanks from 50 countries is at this moment in time an important gathering to think about how we move things forward, not only in our countries but around the world.
Will there be particular areas of focus during this conference?
All of the summits, and they take place at in each of the regions of the world, and this is the culmination, so that there are not only common challenges across regions, but they're, within regions, but globally. And those are both policy challenges, and the focus of all of the summits are focusing on the regional and global policy challenges we face, but also, importantly, equally so in some respects, the organizational challenges, funding, how to communicate to policymakers, and how to reach the public on these important policy concerns. So all of those are issues that we will discuss, and best practices in both how to approach policy and the organizational challenge will be a central focus of the summit.
I've heard you speak before in terms of organizational challenges about communication and how that's a much more important element of what think tanks do now as opposed to in the recent past. What do you think, what does this imply for the business model and the way that that regular think tanks are run?
Well, I think historically the view was that scholars would research it, write it, and policymakers would beat a path to their door because they had great ideas that would transform policy. The reality is that in part was never true. And then more importantly and relevant today is the fact that we live in a sea of information, and there is a lot of noise and a lot of voices and content. And so being able to more effectively communicate, and the advances in technology have essentially transformed how ideas are transmitted. The reality is that policymakers read for less than 30 minutes a day, and they're not reading books, journal articles, or even policy briefs. So yesterday, met with a scholar and administrator at a think tank that, is directly related to supplying information for policymakers, who said that even 10 pages, 8 pages is too much. And so the visual dimension, the podcast, infographics, mobile, using and transmitting what is produced at think tanks through mobile devices are where is meeting both policymakers. And I would underscore that it's not only what is produced, but understanding that there is a new mandate in terms of reaching the public in a way that was never a part of it. The primary view was that, or the dominant view was that policymakers were the primary exclusive audience of what think tanks produce. That is no longer the case. And if we're not reaching the public, and in the context and place that we are in Brussels, that if it's Brussels-centric, if it's in the Brussels bubble and not reaching the states, both the politicians and the institutions, by ignoring that, are doing it at their own peril.
What do you think has changed, given your long history of examining and studying think tanks? What's changed in the environment in which we operate, in that we now need to address the public? And I do agree with you that we do, but what has changed?
Well, I think the ability to reach and connect with the public in a much more direct way has had a direct result in terms of elections, whether they're in Germany or in the U.S. or in Brazil. And so the real lesson and where the pearl lies is that politicians, individuals, not parties, not organized set of institutions like the media, et cetera, that politicians, individuals now can go direct and mobilize significant portion of the population. And that is made possible by advances in technology and social media. And then we now have where the Pandora is out of the box in terms of how to really mobilize and connect individuals who are very disparate and would not in the past either be able to connect with others, and not have a sense that their interest has any connection to anyone else. All of that has been made possible by political strategies, but most importantly by technology. And that's really the game changer.
I think my own observation with that would be, in the past we had to go through an intermediary to reach the public, and that would usually be the media. Perhaps then it's a real opportunity for think tanks to bypass that intermediary and to take a message directly to the public.
I totally agree with that. I mean, I think that I often get questions, do we, in Latin America, for instance, do we have to continue to work through the parties? Technology has changed that you now can go directly to the public and individual politicians and groups now understand that. And I think the sense of urgency is the fact that more think tanks need to understand that, or that void, that vacuum will be filled by things that are not very good and out of our control.
So let's go to our two other guests and get their reaction on that. Milena, perhaps you'd like to tell us a little about your organization and mission first.
Well, just very briefly, European Policy Center, or as we abbreviate it, CEP, is a Belgrade-based indigenous Serbian think tank with a mission to support Serbia's EU accession bid. And to do that through focusing on the real contents, the reforms which need to be implemented in order for Serbia to become not just any member state, but a credible and a sustainable member state of the European Union. So we focus on a number of policy areas, very, very concretely, very specifically, mainly related to good governance, government accountability, some areas of economic reforms, environment, but we also engage in a lot of European and regional cooperation. We are as Permanent Secretariat of a Western Balkan think tank network called Think for Europe Network, which actually works on similar issues for the entire region of Western Balkans. So trying to support and promote, but also work content-wise on issues related to the reforms that Western Balkan countries need to implement in order to get into the EU.
How old is your organization?
We're just 7 years old.
Okay.
And so by Serbian standards, we are a big think tank already. So we are 23 members of staff at this point. So we've grown quite considerably over the past
given 7 years. That you're so young, or your organization is so young, have you always had a focus on communication? Can you identify with what Jim said about intermediation and talking to the public?
Well, I have to say that in the think tank community or civil society community in Serbia, the focus on communications is much, much, much smaller and lower than I would say in EU think tanks and big think tanks, probably in the United States. And the reason is very simple. It's the funding. It's very difficult to get enough overhead in the projects that we run, in the research work projects that we do, that we can really focus on very fancy communication activities. But we try to be as modern as possible and to do the cheap things in-house. So, for example, we do a lot of infographics. We run a blog on our website. We try to reach out to the public, not only through the media, but also directly a lot through the social networks. But I have to say that the reach is extremely difficult. People will still wake up in the morning and want to read what Kim Kardashian ate for breakfast, but he will not want to read about, you know, what's going on in Yemen or what's going on in the Serbia's governance reforms. So it's extremely difficult to reach the public. When it comes to policymakers, for us, it's, I think, a bit easier than for most other organizations in our region, because my organization was basically started and founded by people who used to work for the administration. So we know it inside out. We know where to press. We know who to talk to. We know how to identify the right interlocutors and how to build alliances within the administration for the things that we do. So I think that we have a much, much bigger challenge with reaching to the wider audiences and wider public. And the way we go about it is actually not through communication, but it's through partnerships with more activity-based organizations, organizations who work with the citizens on the ground. So we create synergic projects, I would say, in which my organization would cover the research and the policymaking aspects. And then we feed citizen-centric campaigns, whether they're online or they're on the field, on the ground, just reaching out to people on green markets and squares in the towns and municipalities across the country. But we don't do that as a think tank. We do that through our project partners.
Jim, I think you're a big fan of collaboration between think tanks.
Yeah.
And this kind of model, perhaps...
No, I think that's... in terms of the going forward, the sort of understanding the... policy food chain, and in terms of what is the strength of an individual institution, and partnering for both cost and impact reasons is I think a feature that needs to be embraced by more institutions and promoted. And my hope is that through these meetings that occurs, and it is occurring, in terms of both on the policy side, but also groups across in regions are forming groups on communications and are partnering and visiting the institutions that they've seen and sending their scholars and communication staff, etc., for week-long stays. So that's happening and could happen much more aggressively at institutions, and I think will in the future occur out of necessity.
Right. Let's now ask move on to Ed, and maybe you want to explain to us a little bit about your organization and your mission, but then also how do you approach communication in your organization?
Thank you very much. ASSET is just about 10 years old. We started in 2008. And the objective of ASSET is to support African countries to achieve economic transformation within a generation. We're Pan-African, although we're located in Accra. We cover almost all the sub-Saharan African countries through research and partnerships with a number of organizations in the region. We pride ourselves in saying that we shoot above our hip. In other words, we basically try to broaden our influence through partnership. Now, the first thing that we did when ASSET was established was to have a clear understanding of what economic transformation is, and we did a number of analytical work in that area. And in 2014, we came up with our flagship report, which is the African Transformation Report, which says growth with debt. And the whole idea was to stimulate the discourse around issues of economic transformation, shifting the development discourse from just purely poverty reduction to creating wealth and changing the structural composition of the economies of Africa. So that particular report was seminal in trying to heighten the conversation around the issues of economic transformation.
And given that it had a Pan-African focus, what impact did that have on communication? I imagine that there probably would be linguistic issues, and perhaps some platforms are more popular in some countries than in others.
Well, basically, we cut across all linguistic areas, French, Portuguese, and English. And basically, I mean, in response to your question regarding communications, as part of our own organizational setup, we have quite a robust communication unit led by a director, highly seasoned communication specialist. Mm-hmm. We organize continental events. We've held two African Transformation Forums, one in 2016 in Kigali, which brought together over 300 participants, public policy, about 26 governments, ministers, development partners, stakeholders, sector activists, captains of industries were all party to that conversation, where the whole issue of economic transformation and the various elements of it were being thrashed out. And just June this year, we organized another one, where we even had a panel of African heads of states. Paul Kagame was there, the president of Ghana, and the vice president of Cote d'Ivoire. And then you had also, private sector participants. Dangote was there, and a few other active, networked individuals in the African, economic space were all there to have a conversation on these issues.
And do you think that having a professional communications department has made all of that easier? I mean, what kind of impact has it had in terms of promoting your research?
I think it's phenomenal in the sense that we're able to link not only with the press and the print media, but also through the various channels of communication, social media, Twitter, blogs, policy notes, which are provided on a very regular basis. And I agree with Jim in saying that most policy makers will not even read a 5-page note. And so you need to provide them in snippets. Yeah. And I think with WhatsApp in particular, in fact, if you want to get an African minister's attention, you WhatsApp him, okay, and with particular information, and they almost invariably respond quickly. Yeah. So there are new mechanisms, new channels through information technology, which is really working very well. And we're trying to break the information in bits which are very digestible and very powerful in conveying the messages. And that's what we're trying to do through the communication channels that we've developed.
Digestible is a great word to use in terms of communication. Jim, you've emphasized the need for diversity in our recruitment and the need to bring younger people into think tank leadership roles. What's the thinking behind that? What's your rationale?
Well, I think I would start actually with this panel. I mean, in terms of Ed and Milena, I think the importance of this global summit is the fact that the answers don't lie in Europe or in North America. That is, has been ably demonstrated by Ed and Milena, that there are really important cutting edge in terms of both research and in communications, even when you have to do it on the cheap. But that, you know, the examples that Milena mentioned are important cutting edge that a lot of think tanks don't do. And so there's a lot in terms of diversity, in terms of institutions, et cetera, that are important. But I have, as someone who has taught young people, you know, from around the world for the last 35 years, I think in terms of that it's not about, it's more about innovation and, you know, what keep, I tend to be more a realist and pessimistic about things because of the way that I look analytically at things and tend to see trends that are terrifying and most people don't want to give voice to. And so the diversity part for me in terms of, you know, a concern about where will the next generation of young scholars and think tank administrators and politicians come from. So emphasizing that, and in terms of my own experience, having students who challenge my pessimism, who are optimistic about the future, is important to sort of serve as a balance, a yin and a yang. But also I believe firmly, and there's significant empirical evidence to demonstrate, that innovation and transformation occurs with a diverse workforce and a staff, and that understanding that, making a commitment to it, and advancing in a time when there's political paralysis, where there is, I think, a narrower set of choices for financial and other reasons, and that will require creativity and innovation, that we should do everything possible to make sure that we're recruiting young people, people of diverse ethnic and religious background, and also understanding the important role that women can play in these institutions. And in that context, women tend to be in development and in supportive roles, but not in the upper echelons of think tanks. That's changing. But I think we all, as a community, need to be aware of that. And both in terms of diversity in the broader sense in each one of these areas, that the institutions will be stronger and our policies and societies will be better if we maintain a commitment to those issues.
Yep.
And that it's in the institution's interest, that it's not a policy of affirmative action for the sake of affirmative action, that each institution understands the connection and the value and importance of diversity in terms of improving and innovating their institutions and, more importantly, transforming society.
Yep. Ed, your think tank, in a way, shares some similarity with Bruegel in that our audience covers all of Europe, and therefore we need to reflect that diversity in our teams. Is it the same for you? Do you have a diverse staff to reflect the fact that you're Pan-African?
Absolutely. We have at least 9 African countries represented on our staff. And just to go to Jim's point about recruiting the youth, we've established what you call the African Transformation Fellows. These are young Africans with either masters or PhDs who we recruit through competitive recruitment, at least 3 a year, who would come to ASET to work for a year or two to learn our methodologies, our approaches, and to do deep dive into research. And then from there, because we partner with a number of other African think tanks, national think tanks in various countries where we operate, then we then, you know, send them to these countries to also learn at the level of the think tanks in the countries what the realities are on the ground. So we build their capacities from there. And these individuals either would, if they decide after 2 years to remain with ASET, then we would we'll look at that. If not, they move on to other organizations. But then we are developing a body of scholars, researchers who are grounded in policy analysis, who are capable of engaging with policymakers and other stakeholders within the economic spheres in the countries in which they're operating. So we hold dearly to that. And for us, partnership is key. We punch above our weight by connecting with other partners within the region. We do a lot of multi-country studies. Mm-hmm. And the whole idea of trying to influence policy is that if you bring a group of countries together to learn, to share information about what works and what doesn't work, it has greater traction than just trying to engage individual countries on their own, because they see what their other countries are doing. It becomes a little bit more of a competition,
yeah,
and it spurs them to more policy reform and action. So we set up what you call the platform for dialogue, Pan-African Coalition for Transformation. And these are based on the pathways that we have defined, industrial policies, you know, resource mobilization and management, for example, is key in terms of domestic resource mobilization. How are countries, you know, growing their economies in order to be able to improve on domestic capabilities to finance major investments, operations? You know, these are some of the areas that we're working on.
That program of African Transformation Fellows actually sounds excellent. It crosses countries. It brings in young people and it trains them. Is there a mentoring aspect to that? Are you also encouraging them to be more ambitious and helping them find where they would fit in the policy environment?
Absolutely. In fact, when they come to ASET, one of the things we do every 2 years is that we come up with a flagship report. And the last one was agriculture powering economic transformation. Each of these fellows would take a particular aspect of this, and they'll be mentored by the senior policy advisors and even external reviewers who are also part of this. So basically building their analytical capability to do well-grounded research, but also writing that is powerful enough to convince policymakers, you know, that these are the things they should be looking for. So we mentor them. And that's why for 6 to 9 months, they actually work on research that ASET is undertaking. And then after that, they can be then posted to other countries, where to other think tanks, or even to governments.
Yep. Yeah. I'm glad you've mentioned writing, actually, because teaching scholars to write in a way that non-specialists can understand and the public can understand is actually quite a difficult skill. And Milena, I've noticed that in some parts of the world, especially the region that you've come from, because I've visited occasionally, think tanks tend to have a much younger staff and also a better gender balance when it comes to research roles as well as support roles. Why do you think that is? Is it because you have the right strategies in place? Is it the labor market? Is there something else about the region that makes it easier?
Yes, it's correct. And not only for the think tanks, but for the civil society in general, there is a lot more youth and a lot better gender balance than in some other parts of the world. I would have to say that that has something to do with the fact that the region used to belong to a communist part of Europe, where the role of women in the labor market was even forcibly promoted. So in general, in Serbia and in the Western Balkans, women are much more present in some of those structures, which in other European countries, especially in Western Europe, are much more rigid and traditional in terms of dominance of older and male members. In Serbia, I would say that across the administration, across the civil society, women are, much more present in leadership positions than in some other parts of the world. But I think it's also related to the fact that think tanks and civil society are also a much younger occurrence in our countries. So before the 90s, there were very few think tanks in our country and in the region. And if you would look at the structure of the old state-owned research institutes, or if you would look at the membership of the, for example, Serbian Academy of Science, men are still quite predominant in those structures. So I think that it is the novelty and the youth of the sector itself which has reflected positively on the greater participation of both women and young people. And I would say, for example, in my think tank, in European Policy Center, our age average is around 35 years old. So we have quite a few members of staff who are under 30, and the women comprise around 60% of the total workforce, both directors, both me and my colleague who is the executive director, we are women. The chairman of the governing board is a man, but chairman of the governing or chairwomen, chairpersons of the governing boards, they change more frequently than directors in our case. So I would say that we are in that sense in even a women-led organization. So I think that this is in a nutshell not a result of some deliberate strategies, but the fact that this in our sector and in our country, this comes naturally.
And Ed, what kind of gender balance does your organization have, and did it happen because of external reasons like with Milena, or do you pursue some strategies?
Well, we recognize the importance of having a fair balance between women and men in our organization. And in fact, we make it a deliberate effort when we're recruiting that at least we have women and also staff with language background, if French, English, Portuguese, you know. So we normally make a deliberate effort in doing that. And among the recent recruited, transformation fellows, two are women and one male. And we still have a pipeline of others who are also being interviewed. So we make a deliberate effort, and in our current staff, in fact, until just about 2 months ago, when one lady left, there were more female researchers than there are male researchers on our staff. And we continue to try and maintain that balance, and also regional balance in our recruitment. And as I said, there are at least 9 countries that are represented on ASSET staff today.
Yep. Jim mentioned that, things are going to move in the world, but it's not going to come from Europe or from America. Coming here to Brussels today, what advice could you give Jim and I in terms of what strategies we could use to ensure that we have a younger, more diverse, more innovative, dynamic workforce, especially with researchers, given that we have, for us, we have many legacy issues. If your institution is older than 10 years old, then it's likely to be dominated by men. But what advice would you give?
Well, I would say that, Brussels is not facing the challenges which we face in Serbia, for example, and I think across the Western Balkan countries when it comes to supply of high-quality surplus. I think you have a much bigger supply than we do. In our case, in order to get a good researcher, you have to grow one. So basically, we take people fresh from school very often. It's a huge investment. It's extremely difficult to build strong researchers. It takes several years of a lot of mentorship. I mean, I think that as program director, I think that at least 60 or 70% of my work actually goes into mentoring and reviewing and, working with my younger members of staff. So in that sense, I think this is the only strategy to employ. Reaching out towards young people coming out from universities with the new, with their fresh degrees, diplomas, and investing more in growing new researchers. We also are forced to do that to an extent because we have a very severe brain drain from our country. So I just recently lost one of my best researchers to a Brussels-based think tank. We don't lose people to Belgrade-based think tanks, but we lose them to Brussels-based think tanks. And this is the reality. I mean, in a way, we're proud of it because it speaks of the quality of our research staff, but also it creates a particular challenge. And if I would say that we have one strategy through which we get young people, that's it. We simply have to take young people, new people, fresh people, and teach them how to be policy researchers from scratch.
Do you think a program like your African Transformation Fellows program, Ed, would work in our context in Brussels?
Yeah, I think it would work, and a lot of these fellow programs are springing up. But I know that a number of bilaterals and even multilaterals are supporting fellowship programs, particularly in Africa. I think the situation in Africa is a little bit different. I mean, you know the demographic headwinds. We have growing the cohorts of labor force, the workforce that needs to be trained.
And they're very young.
They're extremely young.
Yeah.
But also you have a growing unemployed graduates because the jobs available are limited and the nature of jobs are changing. And the skills required are also different. So, this is a challenge. There's a real pressure to begin to realign education systems to respond to the future of work. The nature of work is fast evolving with technology, info, and biotech is basically, the disruptions occurring, and particularly in many African economies of automation and what automation means for productivity, but also has a downside effect on job creation, and how governments should position themselves to really take advantage of this automation and create the jobs and train the workforce in that regard. But for the institutions, back to your question on the fellows program, I think one of the things that Africa has done over the last 2 to 3 decades is that it has exported a lot of labor force outside. A lot of Africans, in OECD countries and in North America who are well-trained, educated in some of the best universities. Many of them still very young, in their mid-30s, early 40s, and all looking forward to coming back to Africa. And it offers an opportunity to basically take advantage of this in order to, and that's why our fellows program, we normally when we advertise, we get large number of students, graduates, who are still in the diaspora and looking forward to coming back to Africa to contribute. And when they see our adverts, they become more excited. And I think that offers an opportunity. And I think for the other think tanks, the Western think tanks, I think the Fellows Program offers an opportunity to constantly breed new scholars and create the capacity to really, support policymaking, at the level of those institutions. And this is what we're trying to do in our work in African countries,
Jim, in your observation of think tanks in the US and in Europe, is this one of the problems? Are we not offering the right opportunities to young people? Are the structures of how you progress in a think tank too old?
I think that's part of it. although I think there is a labor force change taking place. I've had an internship, research internship program for 25 years now. For the first time in the last 5 years, I've had students with MBAs and law degrees coming for an internship. which says that, you know, the opportunities within law and within business are shrinking, and many of and the profile of the interns are those who originally started wanting to be in policy, but the lure of the money and the, you know, professional track, they went in that direction, and some, you know, after law school have come back, and certainly now those that are in third year of law school are sort of saying, what are the opportunities? And they're not there, so they're looking at a different path, and are well positioned to do that. So that's an important change. But I think there are two dimensions, which was revealed in the Latin America summit, is the problem we have in communicating to the community at large is what a think tank is, was identified by several of the interns as most kids don't know what a think tank is, nor do they know how exciting it might be. I see, you know, kids who are really super talented, who could really make a difference, who are really energized and now are going on a path in terms of policy, and know what a think tank is. So, that I think is the big issue, is where do you, in terms of this pipeline issue, which I think is key, is how, when do we start? You know, you can't do it after they've graduated, because in the U.S. the problem is the debt is significant. I mean, it's $75,000 a year. And most of that is borne by the student or their parents. And in graduate school, it's mostly by the student. So they're very indebted when they come out. So the big impediment to pursuing a public interest job at a think tank or elsewhere is really driven by, I've got to pay this debt. And so, you know, one way would be in terms of increasing the pipeline is, you know, loan forgiveness in exchange, and there are those models. But also, I think explaining better the opportunities, which most of the students, when they're young, don't understand that they're going to get, you know, $120,000 living in New York or Washington, but the cost of living, they're going to be living in a apartment the size of a closet with two other people for $6,000 a month, and that's going to consume most of their salary. And so my position to them all the time is, you can have a very rewarding financially and in terms of quality of life by working in the policy realm, and not have, you know, the sort of the other dimension for both law and consulting firms is it's a 90-hour week. Yeah, so, there are those things which are not explained, and the value and importance of think tanks, which I don't think generally we do, the value added, the career path within think tanks it needs to be better explained. And that's something I think we can all do as a community better in helping address this problem. The other thing I would say is, on a regional basis and possibly on a global basis, this is where there's the potential of a shared specific pool of positions that could be globally recruited with specific skills that we could all collaborate on and would benefit, because it's a target audience for a set of institutions. And so, you know, that's one area where in cross regions, there is this question comes up all the time, and that's an area where it might make sense to collaborate.
One final point, and I, Jim, you, well, Ed mentioned that the nature of work is changing. I think I've heard you say that in the think tank world too, and that if you're going to go into our business, that you're not going to be just doing research, but that you'll need to do a number of other things. You'll need to exhibit leadership skills, be a communicator, have your own Twitter account, etc. Go on the television, be on the radio, do podcasts. And that actually probably is a more exciting prospect for people at the beginning of their career than what they imagine researchers do, either in a university or a think tank. We're coming to the end of our time. I would like to thank my guests. James McGann from the University of Pennsylvania, Ed Brown from the African Center for Economic Transformation, and Milena Lazarevich from the European Policy Center in Belgrade. Thank you very much for listening to this installment of Bruegel Backstage on the Sound of Economics channel, and thank you to my guests. If you're interested in more of Bruegel's work, you can find more podcast episodes as well as research papers and blog posts on our website at www.bruegel.org. You can also find more about the think tanks and civil society program by going to www.gotothinktank.com and about European Policy Center in Belgrade at www.cep.org.rs. And finally, for the African Center for Economic Transformation, it's www.acetforafrica.org. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.